You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As 2010 came to a close, various economic indicators pointed to a recovery that was picking up speed. In fact, the stock market is up again today. But in his op-ed piece in the New York Times today, Paul Krugman cautions that before we begin celebrating, there's much more that needs to happen. He writes that even if GDP growth hits an impressive 4% in the coming year, the arithmetic of job creation from an unemployment rate of nearly 10% is daunting. I don't think I'm the only one who finds it all a bit confusing, so we have invited R. Christopher Whalen to help us make sense of the current economic recovery and the more than 200 years of American politics and monetary policy behind it. He is an analyst who's appeared on Bloomberg, CNBC, and NPR, and has worked for the U.S. House of Representatives, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and as an investment banker. And he's written a book called Inflated: How Money and Debt Built the American Dream. It's published by Wiley. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Do you agree with Paul Krugman's assessment that the Federal Reserve should spend even more than the $800 billion they put aside to buy long-term bonds in an effort to promote job growth?
Well, the rhetoric of politics is such that Fed chairmen have to associate their interest rate policy with creating jobs. That's what the political need is, obviously. But what the Fed is doing right now, Lynn, is essentially driving people into other assets. They're keeping the rates on Treasury bonds pretty close to zero, even though we've seen medium and long-term interest rates go up recently. And they're trying to force people to put their money into something else, real assets, mortgages, whatever. Because over the last 3 years, people have been retreating and the banking system's been shrinking. Obviously, employment has been badly hurt. And so the Fed is doing what they're supposed to do. What I think Krugman and many left-wing economists fail to appreciate is that over the last 50 years, we've used interest rate policy to essentially goose growth, goose employment in the short-term sense, but we haven't really addressed the more fundamental issue, which is structural, and the loss of jobs overseas, the changes in our demographics, especially, more than anything else.
He's concerned about the Fed raising interest rates later this year. Do you think they should?
There's always an argument between the conservatives and the liberals. You have the hard money tendency, if you will, saying, oh, we're going to have inflation. In my book, I talked a lot about what happened after Abraham Lincoln introduced the greenback and how he essentially used paper money that was backed by nothing to fund the Civil War. At a certain point, those paper dollars traded down as low as 30 cents on the dollar versus gold. In other words, you had to have $30, $40 worth of greenbacks to buy $10 worth of gold.
Did Abraham Lincoln invent Keynesian economics?
No, no. He like many political leaders.
He was a Republican.
Yes, he was. And he was in a very difficult time. Our country was disintegrating politically for a lot of reasons. And he used the issue of slavery, he used other issues to really turn us into a real country. That's what the Civil War was about. It forced us to come together. But he spent several times the national GDP, if you go back to Krugman's point, to prosecute the war. We didn't have the money. My research has led me to the belief that no one ever has the money for war. It's always beyond the reasonable, and it's a function of violence and irrationality, I think.
But the war was followed by a boom time. And,
a relative boom, yes. And the greenback traded back to par by the time of Grant's administration. That was such a demand for money.
And that sort of thing has happened any number of times throughout our history. After the Depression, we had another boom. The Federal Reserve
system. One that was driven by war. You see, I would argue that we never recovered from the Depression. The war, the needs of war and government intervention in the economy are really what pulled us out of the Depression involuntarily.
But we wound up with even greater government debt.
Yes.
And then
yes.
We paid back that debt as well.
No. We actually, coming out of the war, there's no real repayment. The culture of debt had been established by the exigency of the war. And as we went on to the Cold War, again, military spending shrunk as a percentage of the overall economy, but we never really made any attempt to pay it back. There was no Andrew Jackson demanding that we repay debt. So over time, the acceptance of debt, which is really one of the central threads in my book, I think has grown beyond emergencies to everything.
But didn't we eliminate the debt during the Clinton years?
No. You had to. This was one of the things that's always annoyed me over the years. You had people like Bob Rubin claiming to be a hawk on deficits, when in fact he was just using the cash flow from Social Security, the other trust funds, which was running very high at the time, and helped the Treasury essentially finance itself on the back of the future. You remember Peter Fisher, who was in at the Treasury? He said, well, we don't have to issue long bonds anymore. Look at this surfeit of cash coming in as a result of Social Security contributions. So that was a bit of a false period of security for the United States. You had Fed officials predicting the end of publicly traded debt because of Social Security surpluses.
Your book has an introduction by Nouriel Roubini, but he says that the history you cover is not necessarily one that we can learn from because the boom-bust cycles might be beyond history.
Well, it's an interesting point. As I was saying before, if you look at Lincoln and the way that the paper dollar lost value and then regained dollar, what do we say about inflation today, Leonard? The dollar is the global currency today. It's not just a function of the U.S. economy.
And for a while we were worried about it, but it seems to have remained more stable than the euro, which for a while like the new standard.
Well, if you think of it, especially if you think of big commodities like oil, there's only two currencies in the world that are big enough to accommodate it, the euro and the dollar. All the other currencies in the world are far too small to serve as a means of exchange for that type of commerce. So I think you're going to see a seesaw back and forth between the U.S. and the Europeans over the next couple of years. When the Europeans do something right, the euro is going to go up. When the U.S. shows a little bit of courage on the fiscal side, the dollar will rally.
Rand Paul ran on a campaign to get rid of the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
The Federal Reserve is over 120 years old. Why was it created?
Well, it was created, I think, because the bankers, especially who initially had been in favor of hard money and against a central bank. You associate with them with Andrew Jackson, if you will, and Jefferson.
Well, it goes earlier. Yeah, Jefferson was against it and Hamilton was for it.
That's right. Correct. But, you know, over especially after Lincoln and the Civil War, there was established a constituency among American business, especially the railroads, in favor of inflation. They didn't want to have to be forced to pay their debts in gold. And having paper money that was not backed by gold was very convenient. Then the banks, who were national banks specifically, were created to sell the debt during the Civil War. They were allowed to count some of that money twice. They could invest it in treasury bonds and they could lend it. So the effective return on that part of their balance sheet was 15%. That was a lot of money in those days. So the bankers became advocates for inflation too and debt. And this was really the sea change. By the time we get to 1913, they had convinced enough bankers that having a government-sponsored central bank was a good thing because of the crises we kept having, 1907 in particular, that they essentially allowed the Fed to be created, even though the bankers had long resisted it, especially the state banks. Think of the state banks and the national banks as fighting one another during this period. The state bankers were trying to preserve independence somewhat more in favor of hard money, while the national bankers, who were associated with the Treasury and the railroad and the big cities, they liked inflation.
My guest is R. Christopher Whalen. His book, Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream, it's published by Wiley. Was your bank rating agency and consulting firm advising clients against subprime mortgages back in 2007?
Oh, even before. If you go back and read our newsletter, The Institutional Risk Analyst, we started talking about the fact that banks were reporting zero defaults. Whammo. All of these big banks have zero defaults on their. That's not normal. People die. Mm-hmm. People get divorced, whatever. They lose their jobs in any portfolio that size. So we knew that something was wrong simply because things looked too good.
So you were advising against when others were not?
Yes.
Were people listening to you?
No, they didn't want to hear
it. Was it the same thing that happened with Roubini, just a Cassandra?
Yeah, I think Nouriel has definitely suffered from that same symptom. Look, people don't like it when you tell them that their house is worth a third less than they think. They don't like it when they hear from you that their bank may fail. And, you know, we take the same policy as the FDIC. We never talk about banks that are going to fail.
And he's predicting, according to CNBC today, that housing prices can only move down.
I agree with him. I participate along with Nouriel. Well, next year, we're going to have more involuntary sales in this country, that is to say, sales from foreclosure, than voluntary sales. As that happens, when the bank tells the real estate agent, sell this property, get rid of it, whatever the price, right? That's going to pull the comps down in that neighborhood. And so as we work through the biggest part of the mess, which I think is next year going into 2012, in terms of foreclosures, I think prices have to come down. And, you know, I recently helped orchestrate a letter from a bunch of experts asking the Treasury, asking the Fed to move forward with new national standards for what we call loan securitization. That's when a bank makes you a loan and they sell it so that they can go do it again, right? It's a form of liquidity for the bank. We still have no movement from the Fed and the Treasury on this. They're dragging their feet. What happens to all those homes that you can't sell the loans to Fannie and Freddie? Everything over $1 million. There's no liquidity right now, Leonard.
Why are they dragging their feet?
The banks are not advocates of change in any environment. And, you know,
But weren't they hurt and their images hurt?
Well, the settlement today that was announced by Bank of America with respect to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they basically have gotten another subsidy from the U.S. Treasury for their housing losses.
Too big to fail again?
Again, too big to fail. Nothing changes, no matter what laws we pass in the Congress. The relationship between the banks and the Treasury has always been very strong.
So I guess you don't believe that the bad mortgages and credit card debts have run through the system yet?
No, not entirely. I will tell you that our rating system covers all U.S. banks, and it's been looking better since the end of 2009. But the improvement has plateaued. It's flattened out as of the third quarter. And we see little banks, the righteous, I call them, my high-quality institutions, getting better. Clearly, even some very beaten-up institutions, SunTrust, for example, in Atlanta, has improved dramatically.
What about Citibank?
Citi is much improved. We rate them a C now. They were an F for 2 years. But what I would worry about is this, Leonard, as we get into the next year, and this year, and we're still digging through the foreclosure mess, I think you could see signs of stress in the industry again. And remember, they're going to continue to shrink. The banks are going to have to keep shrinking. So this is not going to help the economy, and it's not going to help jobs.
What about AIG?
Government money goes a long way, doesn't it? Ally Financial is another one that has used subsidies very effectively. And look, the bondholders of Bank America, the bondholders of Ally and AIG have gotten away. They have been subsidized by the public, and the Fed and the Treasury tells you that this is all for our good.
Haven't the big banks actually gotten bigger with the help of the government? Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citibank?
Well, they had gotten bigger through acquisitions, some very ill-advised acquisitions. Bank America bought Countrywide without having it go through a bankruptcy first. It was insane. But the government has subsidized that transaction. So
they bought Merrill Lynch.
They did buy Merrill Lynch. But if you look at their total assets and look at all the things they've had to sell in the last year to raise cash, they're actually shrinking. Citi has shrunk by hundreds of billions of dollars. And I think they should be broken up. I think it would be good for the economy if the top four banks were forced to downsize dramatically.
My guest is R. Christopher Whalen, W-H-A-L-E-N. His book, Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream. It's published by Wiley. It has an introduction by Nouriel Roubini. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Christopher Whalen, co-founder and managing director of Institutional Risk Analytics, a bank rating agency and consulting firm. He's also worked for the U.S. House of Representatives for a range of people, Jack Kemp and Fritz Hollings.
Yeah, Fritz was in the Senate.
The Federal Reserve Bank. You've also worked as an investment banker. And his book is Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream, published by John Wiley. You write that Americans have two very contradictory ideas of themselves and their behavior patterns. They believe, on the one hand, that they are reasonably prudent in their spending, and that stems from our country's Puritan roots. And they also believe that they're entitled to anything they desire. And
right now,
to get it, they can spend beyond their means.
That's right. That's right.
But how do we come to develop this contradictory behavior? And should we blame the baby boomers for it?
Well, they're certainly the most recent manifestation. And remember, they come from the war. They're a side effect of the great wars.
I'm getting a theme here that war is really the problem.
Well, it's part of human life. It's part of...
There are two wars going on now.
Yes. I think if you go back to your first question, the tendency of Americans to pull the future into the present in terms of economic gratification, wants and needs, however you want to describe it, I think was a function of just the commercial free enterprise system. I like to juxtapose Ford and General Motors. Ford was a cash company. Henry Ford didn't believe in debt. He ran the whole company on cash until he died. No financial records. He paid all the vendors in cash. Can you imagine that? GM, on the other hand, because of Alfred Sloan, understood the power of finance. And so when you went into a GM showroom, they immediately offered you financing on the car. This enabled GM to grow much faster than Ford. So that by the 60s and the 70s, they were comparing Ford with Chevrolet. They didn't even compare Ford with all of GM anymore. So in the same way, Americans have used debt, have used paper money, too, to finance whatever needs were there. Debt for the railroads, the government's use of debt to finance great wars, and even in the most recent cases, to finance financial crises.
But the boomers are the children, largely, people who lived during the Great Depression.
That's right.
And their parents told them something quite different, didn't they?
Well, they did, but after the Great Sacrifice, remember the greatest generation ever, they came home and they made up for it. They produced lots of babies. They built homes. They gave returning soldiers the right to buy a house.
To go to university.
They gave them all sorts of other benefits. So we created a culture of entitlement that sits right alongside that traditional tough individual work ethic. Think of John Adams. The agrarian, stable society, stay at home, live a consistent, boring life versus the gold rush. Sorry, honey, I'm leaving. I'm going to California. I'll come back with the money.
Was the gold rush the beginning of that American dream? Because people were coming to this country, immigrants were coming from all over the world, and they all suddenly had this opportunity to become very rich.
It's certainly part of the story. It's a very speculative story. Imagine leaving your home, leaving your family and friends in Boston, for example, and getting on a ship and sailing around the Horn of South America to go to San Francisco and pan for gold. But that's what people did. I think it just illustrates that the Europeans who came to this country were looking for a fresh start. They were looking for an opportunity that they couldn't get at home. And in the same way, if you were in the East Coast of the United States in the 1840s and you were seeing opportunities slowly get more and more difficult compared to how things had been, the opportunity of gold in California, which was this, you know, shining unknown place, was somewhat attractive.
Well, we have the idea of instant wealth replacing the idea of hard work and
yes.
saving as a national ideal. But,
that's right.
But you're also pointing out that hard work didn't seem to really be getting people very far.
No, as you get to the end of the 1800s, there is definitely an increase in social discontent, the progressive movement, many other manifestations. And they were basically seeing things that were discussed in the previous program here, the concentration of wealth, people moving to the cities. The model was changing. It was no longer a homesteader model. You were becoming an employee of someone else. You were no longer the independent American frontiersman. You are now essentially working for a robber baron, if you read the leftist press of that period.
There's a gold rush going on right now, fueled by people like Glenn Beck. People are buying a lot of gold. And it was during the Great Depression that America went off the gold standard. You write that some people like Ron Paul have argued for a return to the gold standard.
Well, I don't subscribe to that view. I think the gold standard should not be a discussion that is focused just on that metal. I think what the gold standard and similar types of regimes are about putting limits on politicians, putting limits on their ability to borrow, their ability to print money. And so if you think of it then, if I were going to come up with a regime today, I wouldn't just use gold. I'd want to include precious metals, copper, all of the hard assets out there that can weather the vagaries of a monetary system. In the front of my book, you'll notice there's a quote from Hayek, wonderful quote that summarizes the whole book, which is that no politician in a democratic society can resist the siren call or the demand from the people for services, goods, whatever, today. I mean, look at Mike Bloomberg. He built this wonderful city we have, all of these services, everything else during the boom time, and now he's got to cut them back. All the states around the U.S. are facing the same issue with respect to mandates, with respect to all sorts of spending. And that is running up against politics. So in good times, you know, when after World War II, when the entire industrial world was destroyed and we were the only game in town, it was relatively easy to give people benefits.
Well, Bloomberg also ran into another problem recently because people got the sense that if you lived in a good neighborhood, especially in Manhattan,
yes,
you were going to get services that you weren't going to get if you lived in Brownsville or in Astoria, Queens.
Well, imagine New York of a century ago when my distant cousin Grover Whalen was the meter and greeter of New York, and there were no services for many people in New York City. The wealthy lived around Central Park, and then everybody else lived wherever.
Americans want European-style social benefits, but they don't want to pay the taxes.
No.
So, many people pointed out the contradictions of the Tea Party in that regard.
Yes.
During the election.
Well, even
but
most
it didn't
recently.
Seem to affect the vote.
Look at the vote we just had in the Congress for the tax cuts. And this goes back to Krugman's piece that you started our conversation with. How can we declare victory on growth when we have zero interest rates? You know, this is a very tenuous prosperity we have, I think, if everybody on Wall Street is going to be touting the boom market when the Fed is basically saying money has no value.
President Obama is actually looking at making adjustments to Social Security. The decision has been made not to give a cost of living increase.
Yeah, I think that's a travesty. If you look at something like $750 billion that the Fed is taking away from the elderly, savers, everybody in this country that does the right thing, and then we're transferring all those subsidies to the large corporations, the biggest banks, is that fair? I think the government – and how can the bankers complain about Barack Obama? I mean, how could he possibly be nicer to them? Isn't it astounding to hear what we saw last week and some of the commentaries about how the Jamie Dimon and the other big bankers are complaining, and then we're not even going to give a cost of living increase to the elderly who see – you know, I do all the grocery shopping in our family. I don't see prices going down. We have some really strange things going on in our economy, and it's because of the distortions of the crisis.
But you worked for Jack Kemp. What would he say is the problem here?
I think he would say, as I do in my book, that government is ultimately the source of many of our woes.
Just wanted a flat tax. He thought that would be
right.
The answer to
all
problems.
I would embrace that. I think we need to focus taxation on sales at the transaction level so we can raise revenue. I think we should stop taxing corporate income. It's silly. We tax them once, and then we tax the dividends again. That's ridiculous. We want to encourage private businesses in this country. The government does not create jobs. All they can do is transfer wealth. And every time I hear a politician talking about how government, including Barack Obama, is going to create jobs, no, that's the problem.
Not going to create jobs because the jobs are all moving overseas?
In part, yes.
Certain kinds of jobs are free trade
policies pursued by our government and encouraged by the largest corporations in this country.
But that's been a long-term
policy. Oh, yeah.
In fact, Ed Koch was proud of the fact that manufacturers were moving out of the city, making the city a little classier.
Now we've seen the result of that. Look, you have to have both. You have to have balance. No society can survive based on services amongst themselves. You have to create wealth.
Well, this recovery has been called a jobless recovery.
Yes.
So what does that mean? That means that it's all theoretical or
– No. It means –
you have to have people spending money to have a recovery, don't you?
That's true. But look at it this way. If you take a look at the growth in the government sector in this country and the growth in debt, each time we've had a recession, the Fed has lowered rates lower and lower and lower to the point where they're zero today, and we've gotten a little less growth each time. So what I'm saying is that I think that one of the lessons you can take from my book is that when the public sector gets too big, you start to see the private sector die. And that's essentially what I see in this country. And by die, I mean they're moving offshore. They're moving their production to other countries because they don't want to be here anymore. Currency is too strong. Other costs in the U.S. are too high. Look at California if you want to start a business, or New York. These are very difficult venues to start a business today.
But the dollar is weak. It's not strong.
Oh, no, not in relative terms. I think if you look at the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet, the dollar should be a lot lower. The thing is our
trading partners – tell that to anybody who's going to Europe on a vacation.
Well, no, our trading partners don't want the dollar to go down. They're our creditors. They want to sell us goods.
My guest is R. Christopher Whalen. His book, Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream, is published by Wiley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopez. Let's talk about our creditors. How much more can we borrow from them? What are the chances that some of them will cut us off like China?
Well, that's it's funny. People say that. They say, oh, well, the Chinese will sell their treasury bonds. To me, the thing that keeps the dollar stable is commerce, as we were talking about before, oil, commodities, traded goods. This is why the dollar has managed to maintain its value relatively, even with our profligate tendencies at home. If we start to see a change in that, if you start to see countries deliberately avoid using the dollar for trade, then I think you would have a problem. But the investment part of the portfolio, the Chinese with their $1 trillion in treasury bonds, the Japanese have about the same amount. Who are they going to sell them to, for one thing? And if they sold those dollars, Leonard, where would they go? Would they go into the euro? The euro doesn't want all of that investment inflow into their currency. That's the last thing they want. Would they go to China? No, they don't trust the Chinese. In fact, the Chinese Communist Party members keep their money here because they don't trust their own government. So there's a political dimension to this as well as a financial dimension. And people trust the United States because we're sloppy and somewhat undisciplined, but we're still a relatively free society.
Have they all bought into the American dream?
I think a lot of people around the world still hold great admiration for the United States. They do want to be more like us, but they don't like some of our tendencies.
Well, if you're not wealthy in this country, can the American dream only be achieved by going into debt?
No, it's interesting. I met a college professor when I was just out in Indiana. I have an affiliation with Indiana State University. And he was from Syria, and he came to me and he said, Chris, how is it that people in this country believe that they go out and get married in their early 20s, and they're immediately entitled to go out and buy a house with 80% financing? In his country, you would basically live with your parents for 10 or 15 years. Your wife gets to know the family this way, so there's a benefit. And then you save all your money, and you pay cash for the house. Members of the whole family contribute. They don't want you to have any debt.
This is the way it used to be in this country.
That's right. Well, as my friend Josh Rosser has written about very eloquently, it was forced savings. When my father's parents got to a certain age, they lived out in Queens, they sold the house. They bought a trailer out near Long Island, and they spent their last years with the potato farmers. Their expenses went down. That was the American dream then. But today, we have a whole generation of baby boomers you were just talking about who are going to go into retirement with no savings.
Well, to some degree, because the market went down and other problems occurred.
Yeah, but do we really want people's retirement income to be dependent upon speculative propositions like the equity markets? No. You finance retirement with debt. Look at an insurance company. Do they really want to gamble the entire balance sheet on equities? No, they want to put it in bonds.
Do you think that spending will get back and under control once we pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I do think we need to spend less money on our international responsibilities. I think we have to spend more money in this country. But, you know, even more important than that is, what is the growth rate in this country, the normal growth rate, without extraordinary measures from the Fed? Can we get this economy back so that savers are actually earning a decent return and businesses can invest in the future? Because right now, you can't call this economy we have today normal,
but
far from it.
The next big fight is going to be in Congress over whether to raise the debt level once again.
That's right.
And what would happen if we don't raise the debt level?
Well, the government would go into default. We would have to have a conversation with our creditors. This is going to happen at the state level anyway. I don't think the federal government will default because they can buy their own debt, as the Fed is doing right now.
Although there are a lot of people in Congress saying they're going to vote against it.
Well, that's right. You're seeing a resurgence of the hard money conservative tendency. But these are the same people who have been voting for tax cuts for years. So, you know, this is a peculiar conversation.
Well, Paul Krugman and others argue for strong works progress with infrastructure investment. That would cut down on unemployment, wouldn't it? That's what happened during the Depression.
How much more money can we borrow? I'd like to find out where the bottom of the pool is first. See, the problem I have with Paul Krugman—
But doesn't it pay back, ultimately? Didn't all the buildings that we built during the Depression, the hospitals and
well,
the
that
highways
was different.
And all that?
You had so little debt in those days that a little bit of debt got you a lot of growth. The trouble now is we're spending so much money on debt service that the incremental debt doesn't give us much bang for the buck anymore. So, yeah, look, Keynesian economics is only possible as long as you can borrow money. As soon as you got to get down to a cash economy, Keynesian economics becomes superfluous.
Well, before you go back to the American dream, do you believe that home ownership will once again play a major role in the American dream?
Yes, but it's going to be a much less exciting, much less speculative market. You know, we increased home ownership in this country almost 10 percentage points, looking at the whole population during the boom. Many of those people should never have bought a home. It was not appropriate for them. And now many of them have to get out of the home, go through a default and everything else. It's a horrible thing. Those people should have been renters. And if we had a somewhat more honest marketplace for home mortgages, if people understood what they were doing, I think we would have avoided hurting those people. Because think of it, a 20-year-old buys a house, two-income family, just barely gets into the house, and then they end up defaulting a couple of years later. That's a catastrophe for that family.
We have less than 30 seconds, but there are some states that have spent well beyond their means. What's going to happen with those states who might default?
It's happening here in New York. You're going to have a reduction in spending, and you're going to have a very tough battle over mandates, pensions, everything else for public sector employees. Because over the years, they've treated themselves very well. The average public sector employee earns twice what somebody earns in the private sector for the same job. We can't support that.
That's the argument of the Manhattan Institute. They're anti-union.
Well, I don't think it's so much about being anti-union. We had peace in the labor movement in this country for many years because we gave people such fat benefits. Look at Ford and GM again. Look at what they've had to go through in bankruptcy.
R. Christopher Whalen's book is Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream. It has an introduction by Nouriel Roubini, and it is published by Wiley. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Happy New Year, everyone.